This is BioSci 103 for Friday, April 29th, 2011. Have a couple of very quick administrative announcements before you begin. You should be getting a 3x5 card. Just write your name on that and write what your life is going to be. One complete sentence, what your life is going to be like 44 years from now. So that's your attendance quiz for today. Your emails, your dozens and dozens of them, I'm getting to as soon as I can, as quickly as I can. But if the only thing that it's about is the final exam, then just put yes or no in the subject line so I don't have to open it. No, help. I'm not coming in Monday until, well, I have a full weekend of other kind of stuff. I'm not coming in one Monday until I get that final exam ready to be run off, so it will be easily early Monday afternoon. Okay, by popular demand, here is the subject for today. How students have changed over the last 44 years. Okay? Every time a faculty member walks in front of a room like this one, the first question is, who are these people anyway? These people that you're going to stare at for 45 hours over a 15-week period. These people who are going to memorize your wardrobe and whose wardrobes you're going to memorize also, okay? That happens when you stare at people for 45 hours. Before I get into this discussion, I want to sort of relay a little bit the evidence and the experiences that go into my comments for the next 45 minutes. Since 1966, my first teaching assignment after I got my office key from the secretary, who thought I was a student and made me wait half an hour, my first assignment was 7:30 Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday morning, Zoe 1 in Love Auditorium. And this is before they remodeled it, so there were about 300 people in there. And ASUN published your teaching evaluations, which are now deep, dark secrets hidden away in your chairman's file. So since that time, I've given out approximately 15,000 grades. We've had at least 150 undergraduates doing research in the lab, some of them more successfully than others. Taught at Cedar Point since it opened, and every summer since it opened in 1975. And when you teach at Cedar Point, then you spend a lot of time on the road, on the highway, driving to study sites, listening to the student conversation behind you. So I've listened to at least 2,000 hours of student talk from a van load of people. I've read at least 300,000 pages of student writing, and it may be closer to 500,000. Of course, we've watched our own children grow up. Faculty members, grown-ups, you know, they have a habit or a tendency when it gets to be Friday afternoon to go on off to the bar. And what happens in the bar, of course, is a lot of what we talk, big talk. And we talk about science, we talk about politics, we talk about academic politics, we talk about ethics, we talk about professional issues. Most of all, it's fairly big talk. One day, about 15 years or so ago, I had a graduate student in the lab named Ben Hanelt. And as a result of that, we were sort of talking. And I had all these undergraduates who were really, really smart, doing superb research. I mean, they really were doing excellent work, and most of them were young women. So I said, no faculty member in his right mind says to some 19-year-old co-ed, hey, you want to go to the bar and talk big talk? I mean, you just don't do it. So I said to Ben, how do we engage these students in the kind of conversation that we have as faculty members in a non-threatening way, where they're not going to get hit on down at Barry's or somewhere? So he said, let's just go to the coffee house at 3:30, and we'll have coffee every Friday afternoon. And when that's all over, then the grown-ups can go to the bar. So that's a great idea. So Friday coffee really ended up being, until my last graduate students graduated, ended up being a weekly focus group on the university. And we talked about science, we talked about politics, we talked about professionalism, we talked about professional ethics, we talked about workplace issues. And over the course of a 1 or 2 year period, when you have that conversation every week in a mixture of people who have a lot of different ages, different levels of experience, then you come out of that not being surprised at what happens to you professionally over the next number of years. And I honestly believe that those 15 years of Friday coffee, which are now pretty much ended, the Crescent Moon is not open anymore, and the undergraduates who work in the lab have gotten to be 21, so they should go straight to the bar. Crescent Moon is still open in the morning.
Morning and at night.
Morning and at night. It's got to be open at 3:30 in the afternoon. So what do you see, really, from the front of this room over the years? What do you see, what do you hear about, what do you learn from all this academic experience? Well, you see a lot of success, you see a lot of failure, you see a lot of romance. You read 500,000 words from your future citizens, 15,000 of those future citizens. You look back on kids who made pretty good grades, some of whom did not make pretty good grades, but ended up being physicians that either prescribed drugs for your own children or did surgery on them a couple of times. But most of what you really see is this microcosm of evolving, of an evolving nation. So if you want to actually find out what the United States is going to be like 20 years from now, 30 years from now, when you all are 40 and 50 years old, then look around the room. Look around the room. The one thing you absolutely see, and this is characteristic of your generation of college students that was not necessarily characteristic of your parents' generation, is this enormous heterogeneity or difference. And that includes religious diversity, family histories, employment. Students nowadays statistically are all working, and the University of Nebraska has the highest, at one point in the last 5 years, I know they had the highest number of hours per week of student work outside of the classroom of any university in the country. Some of you are going to school online, some of you are going to school not only here but at Southeast Community College. You're doing everything in the world you can to, and this is much different than your parents' generation. Some of you have been in the military, some of you have not. You have a lot of different co-curricular activities, your ethnic backgrounds are very diverse. You're highly diverse in terms of your talents. Every sample of university students of this size contains magnificent musicians, mathematicians, artists, writers, what have you. The one thing in which you are quite different from your parents and from the people who inhabited my large classes in 1966, 67, and 68 are the three with asterisks. You get a lot of advice from high school, and one of the reasons I believe you do is because of the nation's colleges and universities recruiting efforts, and it's a statistical fact that any student who has a very solid career goal stays in school for a second semester, second year, and that stay in school for a second and third year has big time economic impact on the university's budget. So there is this active recruiting from high school. Your reading skills are not up to the level that your parents were, and you just don't read that much, and your attention span is but a fraction of what your parents had when you come to class. That doesn't mean you're dumb. That doesn't mean you're incompetent. It just means that you're easily distracted and you don't practice reading as a group. As a group. The university is working overtime to globalize its student population, and whether they realize it or not, the university administration is also hiring in a way that is rapidly globalizing the faculty. I did a survey. I didn't really analyze your information sheets, but I did a survey in 2007 of my 101 students, and these were all of the languages either spoken or studied for more than a year. And I've done three of them. The last one, Spanish, as a senior citizen hosting Latin American students in the laboratory trying to write letters. Okay. Students in that particular class, and I think they're probably exactly typical of yours, had visited at least 62 different nations, including some of them, like this one right here, that your nation probably considers a terrorist state. So here are some of them. Here's the rest of the list. They had been all over the world, including Sudan, of course. And that may well have been the a semester in which I had a Sudanese refugee in campus in class. He did just fine. The number one difference between your parents' generation and your generation is information technology. That is the one factor that is influencing higher education more than any other single one. This one, of course, comes off of Flickr. That's a pretty easy mid-60s telephone. This one's my own smartphone, and I was kind of frustrated trying to take a picture then. I took lots and lots and lots of photographs, and every photograph that I took showed a reflection of me trying to take a picture in this phone. Okay? So the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, this is very metaphorical, that you cannot interact with that phone in a way without that phone capturing you in some reciprocal way. And, no, this, I should tell you the story about this particular smartphone, okay? Now, I have all these golfing buddies, and last summer we were out at the golf course, and they all pulled out, you know, afterwards, and having a beer, they all pulled out their smartphones and started bragging about them. And so I looked at those things, and I thought, I've got to have a cell at one of those smartphones. So I went down to Verizon, and lo and behold, they were having a 2-for-1 sale. So I thought, okay, I'll buy my wife one too. So I looked through these, and this thing looked too big and square and clunky. And I said, okay, and I looked at all of them. Here was the LG Ally, right? And it was a gorgeous phone, and it really felt good in your hand. I mean, it was sensual. And I'm thinking, if there's any phone that you're going to buy for your wife, it's one that you think is beautiful and feels good. Okay? So I bought her this phone. I can assure you that the only way for me to prevent her from throwing this phone out the car window as we drive down the street is to say, I just love a high-tech girl. She and this phone do not get along. Okay? So why don't this phone and my wife get along when I can pick up that same phone and just do fine? Well, you have to be vulnerable to being trained by your phone or your computer or any other information technology that you are using. Every time something doesn't work right, that piece of technology is saying to you, don't treat me this way, treat me another way. Don't hold down on me here, just touch me there. And so you have to be willing to be trained, okay? It's not funny, ladies and gentlemen. What is your technology training you to do? I'll tell you exactly what it's telling you to do. All you have to do is, what it's training you to do, all you have to do is go over to Avery and walk up there on the second floor right before class, and what do you see? You see a bunch of folks plugged in, doing this. Okay? They're not happy. They're not talking to one another. They don't even know that there's somebody sitting next to them. This is not healthy. So this slide really came out of another technology talk that I thought I'd sort of throw out. The whole issue of technology shaping culture, of course, is as old as the La Salle cave paintings. I thought about this one simply because the ancient Egyptians made plenty of cat mummies, and that's a pretty good thing to do with all the campus cats, if you want to know. But this little phrase right here, I'm going to charge up my iPod, download some music, email some photos of what I'm saying to my friend in Mexico. That strikes none of you as strange. It strikes absolutely none of you as strange. However, if you were transported back to this time and made that statement in a language that they could understand, they would probably execute you immediately. Or establish you as a god. One of the two. By way of perspective on your life 44 years from now, I thought I'd just lay out my timeline. And starting in 1937 to today, April 29th, 2011. I remember very, very well my mother crying when the atomic weapons were dropped on Hiroshima. I remember very well Sputnik and Apollo 11 moon landing. The reason this is a 15-year period. The reason that 15-year line goes a little bit to the left of Sputnik is that was when I was in high school, and I distinctly remember this girlfriend who did not want to go to a grade B movie called Destination Moon. And finally she agreed, and I dragged her to the movie. So this is Destination Moon. 15 years later, which goes in a eye blink, 15 years later, I'm a faculty member at the University of Nebraska, and I walk out in our backyard, take our oldest daughter by the hand, bring her into the basement, sit her rear end down in front of a black and white TV, say, "Here, Cindy, watch this," and Neil Armstrong gets out of the lunar lander, makes his footprint on the moon, and says, "The giant step for mankind." The single greatest scientific adventure, exploratory adventure in the history of humanity is now gone into the depths of institutional memories. None of you have any clue what that adventure really, really meant at the time and what it was like. MS-DOS was bought by Microsoft from a company that developed an operating system called QDOS, which stands for Quick and Dirty Operating System. So once they bought it, then they renamed it. Email, internet, and today. So when you get to be my age, think back, you know. My father was born in 1912, before there were really airlines. Okay, my grandfather was born in the 1860s, long before there were automobiles, blah, blah, blah. I had a friend one time who was the only son born very late in his father's life. His father was the only son born very late in his father's life. And his grandfather had been alive when Thomas Jefferson was alive. Okay, as a baby. So the time goes in a hurry. Thinking about time, I thought what I'd do is maybe read you a couple of paragraphs from, since you've been doing all this writing, I thought I'd read you a couple of paragraphs from a Janovy book. This is a fossil sponge called Siphonia, and there was a time over in a museum when the exhibits in the invertebrate collections were handled a little bit differently. And one of these years, I went over there and put a scientific name, on 3x5 card and came out here and passed them out. Okay? Long before Google, long before the internet, 3 double-spaced pages, 5 papers in a class like this without once mentioning the unmentionables, which are, of course, money, health, agriculture, the military, sex, sports, and religion. Okay? So imagine writing some of these papers, which were really fairly challenging, without mentioning any of the things that seemed to be so incredibly important to the average American. Students who got the card that said Siphonia Tulipa on it was a young lady from Ainsworth. And her name was Tammy Percival. And here's Tammy's story. Her trek through the arcane jungles of invertebratology began when she was given a small card with an odd name on it, Siphonia Tulipa. Go to Wonderland, she was told, and find Siphonia Tulipa. But when she climbed the shining marble staircase, Morrill Hall, seriously, pushed open the ancient creaking doors, she found so many elegant items that she forgot Siphonia Tulipa for a time and became lost among the rock leaves, stared back at the stone eyes looking up at her from their beds of green felt, took a trip back 400 million years, riding there in the frozen, writhing arms of the black star, felt sadness for the crushed flowers that were not real flowers at all, but sea lilies from a far-off time. Around her, the children played and ran calling to one another to come look at all the strange creatures made of rocks and epoxy and information and the hard work of people who dug into the earth for evidence of past worlds. I must find Siphonia Tulipa, Tammy thought, eventually, and when I do, it will be the most beautiful of all of these wonders. She was wrong. It was not the most beautiful nor the most complex of fossils in the museum, but it was hers. For upon the card she'd been given was not only a lyrical name, but also an assignment. Write a story about Siphonia Tulipa that will make one of these children want to grow up to be just like me. Forever young of mine, forever curious about the lives I cannot live. She leaned over then, staring closely through the glass, and asked her questions of the rock. What is your secret? How do I make a person choose an animal, then because of that choice, choose a life, just by telling a story? What kind of a story would this be? Now in the hot mid-morning, Tammy stalks through the weeds with the same sharp curiosity that she had entered the museum. She's just as surrounded by wonderland, just as aware of her ultimate task and labor that follows, and just as ready to ask the same questions of the damselflies as she'd asked of the cold rock. What is your secret? But she's older now, 5 years down the road, and she knows the secret. Giant problems have giant powers of attraction. They consume your thinking time, lead you into exotic and dangerous places, turn you into a monster your friends don't recognize. So you get new friends. People who will walk through the weeds and choose giant problems as readily as they choose damselflies. So she is now a tenured faculty member at Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas, and sat right back there about where Seth Peterson is sitting and wrote those five papers. The hourly lives of your generation, every hour. Many, if not most of you, deal with iPods, podcasting, smartphones, text messages, all of this stuff, all of it. And because I've been in this business and been dragged along for the last 44 years by having to deal with students and converse and feel like I at least know something about my clientele, I've had to do the same thing. So, sure. Not too long ago, I asked Krista what her favorite music was. So when she called me on the cell phone, I would recognize her. So I use this stuff regularly. You might ask your parents and your grandparents about their use of technology, because that difference is really the difference between you and them and the students that they came to college with. So, what are the main differences between you all and your parents or your grandparents? I picked a 72 Gran Torino because it was one of my favorite vehicles. So we're talking about a lot of time. First of all, you are far more deferential to authority than your parents were, and a whole lot more deferential to authority. You defer to authority, you defer to me, than students were from the 1960s. I have a little box there that says pre-dent essay to remind me of this story that I will tell you. 3 or 4 years ago at Cedar Point, there was a student who was a pre-dent major and was getting ready to apply to dental school in the fall. So she asked me if I would read her personal statement. You know, all of these applications to professional schools require some kind of a personal statement. So I read through it, you know, and there were a little grammatical error here and there. I had a few suggestions, but it was one of the most eloquent pieces of writing that I had ever read. It started out with what the tragic death of her younger brother had done to her feelings about life in general, and about searching for your dreams, and about thinking about your role in the world. And then she followed that with a long narrative of a personal friend that she had, who was a dentist, who was a role model. And a role model not just because this person had a dental practice and was doing just fine financially, but because of this person's demeanor, this person's, the way this person simply lived his life. And I read that, and I can tell you right now, I have read thousands upon thousands of essays. I was on the Honors Program Admission Committee for 20 years. Every year we read 600 or 700 of those high school essays. I've read lots of this stuff. This was one of the most compelling personal essays I've ever read. My reaction to that, had I been on that committee, was admit this kid now. Okay? So she came back to school in the fall, took this essay over to the Health Pre-Health Professions Advising Center in Old Father Hall. And a couple of weeks later, she came back and showed me the essay. And so I said, Amanda, what happened? She said, well, the Aaron went through my essay and suggested all of these changes. And it was paragraph after paragraph after paragraph of how I shadowed this dentist, how I shadowed that dentist, how I this and that and another thing. And all that deeper meaning was gone. Okay? It was simply gone. And so I would advise you to maybe not be quite so deferential to authority. Okay? What you might do, if you're interested, is go back on a blackboard, look through all of those writing spreadsheets. Everywhere there is an extra point, is some place that a student has said something that leaps off that page as being original, as being deep, as being thoughtful, as being unique, as being expressed in a way that tells me more than what that assignment really was. Okay? You are deferential to authority. You are far more inclined than your parents were to turn to authority instead of yourselves for the answers to some problems. And of course, this one, you know, I'll apologize to any of y'all who may be big-time Republicans. That's fine. It's just too, it's too much of a temptation to use this kind of picture. However, it's not too much of a temptation to bring the No Child Left Behind legislation. And from working with the public schools on a number of very large grant proposals, which did not get funded, but nevertheless, dealing with public education, talking with lots and lots and lots of teachers, it's very, very clear that the one thing No Child has done, No Child Left Behind, has done is provided a lot of employment opportunities for statisticians. So the underlying educational philosophy is testing and punishment. Testing and punishment. And if you think for 1 minute that teachers who have been told, test, your children must do well on these tests or you will be punished, that shapes the interaction between the material and the instructions and the students. And this cartoon probably says more than I could ever say about what I subjectively, impressionably believe is this inclination to turn to authority instead of yourselves. You are far more concerned with grades than your parents were. I mean, really, really far more concerned. I would say that over my entire career, 44, 45 years, there have been three cases in which students have been so stressed out over grades that I felt like I had to keep them in conversation long enough to convince myself they were not self-destructive. Three times. Those three instances have all happened in the last 2 weeks. I've seen more grade stress out of this class in the last month than I've seen in the last decade. Okay? Get over it, folks. Just get over it. When you give grades to 15,000 people, you see an enormous amount of success over the long run that has absolutely nothing to do with grades. Okay? If you really want to be someplace, you're going to end up there. Just keep working at it. All right? Just keep after it. Keep after it. And if it doesn't happen, take the other road and do something different. If we had another 2 hours, I could tell you at least 50 stories of people from this room, who did not get what they wanted from a professional school and ended up infinitely better off for it. Financially, every way. You are far less concerned about ideas than your parents were. Okay? You want information and you want facts. When you Google looking for an image to illustrate ideas, what you get is a cartoon light bulb. In the last 5 years and maybe in the last decade, when I've asked students to give me some conceptual interpretations, I instantly get dozens of emails asking me what is a concept. And I send them to the dictionary and I still get questions. What is a concept? Well, this is a concept car, but these are some of the pictures you get when you Google concept. If I had any advice, it would be to maybe go back and talk to your parents and talk to your grandparents about the ideas that shaped their world, the ideas that were present at the time, the political imagery, the concepts of how things ought to be and whether or not those things turned out to be that way. So ideas and concepts will immediately set you aside from your colleagues who are not listening to this lecture. You're far less patient with your dislikes than were your parents, okay? Far less. A year or two ago, because I had to miss class, we were in the middle of evolution, I said, okay, just put up on Blackboard a 250-word Friday writing on the subject. The role of evolution in my country, or something like that. At least half of those students started off their little essay with evolution is a touchy subject. Evolution is a touchy subject. So I added Jackson Pollock just because of the I Hate Art t-shirt. You would be surprised how many of you included the phrase, I really don't like art, in your Sheldon paper. You would be surprised. I would never go in here unless I was assigned. You are far less concerned about ethnicity and sexual orientation than your parents were, and very much less than students were in the 1960s. Martin Luther King, of course, is on the left, and on the right is Robert Mapplethorpe, who is responsible for massive moral outrage from places like Cincinnati when some of his photographs appear in an art museum. You are far more committed to a career track than your parents were, and certainly more than students from the 60s. I don't know when I have heard it said so often, I'm going to be a blah blah, and I'm majoring in blah blah, and I'm this, and I'm that, and I'm that, and I can't take advantage of this opportunity because my advisor says not to. All right? Let me tell you something about careers. Here is sort of the image of college that I think this is my impression of what, you know, people sort of outside the institution think about. Student comes to college, takes some gen ed requirements, then takes all the good stuff, which is my major, all right, has this successful career, happy marriages, all their kids are above average, blah, blah, blah. They get wealthy. They make this big donation to the University of Nebraska Foundation. And the instant you graduate, trust me, you will get communications from the foundation and from the Alumni Association. And the whole idea is to establish that mailing list so that you will continue to get those requests for money as you become very successful. This is the sort of linear life track image, all right, that you all bring and that your parents thought about bringing, but these boundaries were a whole lot fuzzier. The simple truth is, faculty members constantly ask, how do we turn this group of wonderful people into critical thinkers, skilled communicators, citizens who are habitually analytical and have, or at least try to have, a true understanding of all of those realms of human endeavor that we've engaged in as Homo sapiens for the last 30,000 years with ample evidence to support that figure. So when what they really want to be is doctors, dentists, med techs with a job, married. I think one thing that faculty members see that students who are sort of under the thumb of a go this track system is the striking diversity in student capacities, student abilities, represented by all of those different ovals and the different kinds, modeled. The massive number of opportunities that, by and large, people of your generation simply do not see, and those are all represented by those squares. And the multiple kinds of interactions between the different people and the different opportunities. And so this kind of picture right here, this model of diversity of human resources, diversity of opportunities, and diversity of interactions between people and resources is what we see from the front of the room. And if you let it, the system will pick out one of those for you. Not only is that network sort of obvious to us, if you lay that out on society, then society contributes another big layer of complexity. And when complexity is present in opportunities, diversity is present in opportunities, then there may be a whole lot of things that people will do with their lives that have nothing to do with what they decided in the beginning. The only reason that's an Oklahoma City map is because I was working on an exercise in one of my other classes about a head lice epidemic, and I thought, who deserves it more than Oklahoma City? So. It turned out to be a little more difficult than I thought. Okay. Well, the take-home message from faculty members getting acquainted with our students and paying attention to the lives they lead: you're not your parents, and you're not your grandparents, but you are, in fact, your nation's future. You really are. Okay. And you have some simply enormous problems to solve. Problems of staggering size. Problems that have a major biological component. Racism, sexism, unwanted pregnancy, one of the really hot button issues in today's political discourse. Global energy distribution that you have no control over whatsoever. Intellectual and cultural richness, which you have to work at. Definition of a human being. And this definition of a human being, this question, what is a human being, is really the leading question of your time. And your fellow humans are answering it. They're answering it with military action based on religion. They're answering it with technology that is taking your privacy away as fast as it can go. They are answering it with technology that is looking into your genes, the genetic information that spells you. Okay? Infectious disease evolution, relationship. The list goes on. The scientific and technological explosion is not going away anytime soon. I mean, it simply is not. And from the time that your parents were in school, from the time that I walked into this institution in 1966, that technology, the technological change has been increasing changing at an increasing rate. It's better to be educated than it is to be ignorant, and that's true of all realms of human endeavor. I thought I'd introduce you to two kids who sat right down here. Went out to the field station as undergraduates, decided to become an item, stayed to work on parasites of fishes, went off to the University of Wisconsin, became something that they had never become before, molecular biologists and immunologists, ended up on the faculty at Notre Dame, millions of dollars of federal money studying the immunology of tropical disease and drug resistance and malaria, bringing their children back to their roots, the very place where they started that journey, wading in the South Platte River near Roscoe. And you can see that Mike and Mary Ann are more interested in doing this than their kids are. They're complaining. I would go back to finish, really, my parting shot relative to science. Is this quote from Lawrence Slobodkin, who was at the State University of New York in Stony Brook, a book called Simplicity and Complexity in Games of the Intellect. Natural world is not logical in any obvious way. Science doesn't consist of you trying to force your logical system on the natural world. But reducing your preconceptions so that the world imposes its logic on us. Okay? It's very difficult. You have to minimize your ego, which the modern political discourse does not do, and you have to maintain your full powers of receptivity and observation, which is really difficult to do when your technology is training you to do otherwise. Okay? So I'll see you all Tuesday afternoon at 1:00.